In this special edition, enjoy the full-length interview between Denise from The Queer Truth and Reek Bell from the Black Seed Collective. Have a listen.
Tell me what your involvement is with the collective.
Sure. I have been a member of Black Seed since about the summertime. I have been involved with Black Seed when they were formerly known as Black Brunch, and did a couple Black Brunches with them in 2014. As far as this last most recent action, I have been a part of organizing different aspects of it, but really the tasks and responsibilities and roles have been shared across the board. It's been a lot of people putting a lot of different work into it. But as far as my involvement with the group, this has been something we've been working on for a while now. And throughout the holidays and some traveling, was able to come back and get right back into the work around this. But a little bit more of my involvement. Yeah. So, the roles of performing in the actual piece itself is a lot. So I appreciate that a lot of the different tasks and everything have been kind of distributed. And it's really, in Black Seed, we prioritize being a leaderful and really consensus-based, and this whole action has kind of been followed that value.
But could you explain what Black Brunch was?
So in Black Brunch, we would target different areas specifically, and it started around brunch areas. And often those were in Berkeley or areas that are definitely have more of like a white presence in what they are, the restaurants or the places are, who they are really for. But I was involved in some in Berkeley. There were some in Walnut Creek specifically, all throughout the Bay. But Black Brunch, basically, we go around and go into different establishments, restaurants, and now it's become kind of like a style of doing it, not so much targeted specifically at brunch places, but initially that's how it began. And then we would go in and we would read off the names of the dead, the names of the murdered, the names of people that have been affected by the anti-Black genocide, and we would hold space for those names, and then we would peacefully leave and exit the spaces that in which we were in. We would hold space for that, and then we would continue to go on to the next space, and kind of demand that to be visible, demand to be heard in those moments, and hold space for our people that are living and are dead and are fighting in the terrorism that we live in.
Now, one thing that always intrigues me, because I used to live on the West Coast, is that a lot of people on the West Coast, and specifically in the Bay Area, in Berkeley, in the areas that you just talked about, consider themselves to be very progressive, liberal, mm-hmm. sometimes even radical. Mm-hmm. Many of these spaces are essentially, in practice, white-only spaces. Communities of color have been moved out, shifted, and gentrified out of those areas. Have you seen some sort of raising of the consciousness of the supposed natural allies of the progressive white folks that surround Oakland?
I wouldn't really say that I've seen a shift in consciousness. I think the it still is the liberal progressive like sanitization of radical politics is still very present in the Bay, I would say, and especially because of the gentrification that is happening here at such a rapid rate, that especially some of that liberal progressive kind of community values are not with a lot of the tech industry and people moving in. That's not really being like a value that they share. So I don't necessarily think that I've seen like a shift in consciousness for the better as far as like people trying to build coalition with the work that we are doing because of the gentrification that is already happening in such like a rampant pace and the displacement that's already happening in such a way. I say that sometimes the liberal progressive rhetoric of the Bay, actually, it feels like an added aspect to try and fight through that because it is so pacified in this complacency. But we can only hope, right, that the consciousness continues to shift. And we have built coalition. And in this most recent action, that there was some involvement with some white folks that were in a affinity group of a group called Bayset. And I haven't really worked with them much in the past. And so like there are some coalitions, but as far as like the norm of like the culture of the communities here because of the displacement in such a way, and I can only speak to Oakland living here, I don't really feel like I've seen like a shift of anything. If not, it's like caused more of an annoyance from these people that are moving in that want this image of Oakland, and who I feel like have this like sense of, oh yeah, like Oakland is really about community, but it's like community at a distance, community when it's not a disruption, community when it's not an inconvenience, or we're not talking about death, we're not talking about murder, you know. I don't really think I've seen that, but I would like to mention that I've only lived in Oakland for about 2.5 years. I'm from the East Coast, so I'm not even from Oakland myself, but in those last 2 years, it's been really amazing to even just see how quickly the displacement, the gentrification is happening here.
Talk more about the collective, how you decided, okay, you know, this is something I can get involved in.
So I kind of found out about it through Black Brunch and was able to stay in contact from just like a sign-up sheet going around at one of the Black Brunches. So I was able to find out about when a general meeting was happening. But what really interested me in Black Seed is that they were prioritizing women and queer and trans voices in leadership, and that it really seemed to be a leaderful, consensus-based collective that really values the intentional relationship building. Like that's something that like really hold deep in my heart with Black Seed, is that I feel, I mean, in order to do these things, right? Like to do these things in which you're putting your body in such like an unsafe place, and you have to really feel held down by your community and trust like the comrades that you're doing this work with. And it feels really good to have found like a political home collective where in which that we really like have each other, because you can say that within a lot of like activist grassroots direct action groups, but I really feel that in this group. But a lot of just like the structural breakdowns that are often sometimes lost in activist groups as far as really being leaderful and consensus space is what really brought me into Black Seed and the prioritization of queer and trans voices in leadership.
And how does Black Seed communicate that prioritization of queer and trans leadership?
We communicate that by like, we try and also, I mean, bring that up as like who we center in describing ourselves as a group within our points of unity and our values that is constantly mentioned. And throughout, I mean, most of us are queer or trans. So it's also just like a thing that ends up happening in the way that we structure our group. But as far as it's a part of our structure and a part of our resources that we share with people, try and make sure that is known and centering that in whenever we discuss the group.
And are there some sustainability practices? Because as you mentioned, you're doing this direct action work that has very real consequences. That means that for many of you, your names are now in a database, you're fingerprinted, you're sort of on the lookout. And as we know, you know, the police, the FBI, they're not above targeting activists in that way. So how do you deal with that, those stresses on top of just your everyday stresses? How do you make that work sustainable?
I think a lot of that is a lot of processing too, and a lot of processing with groups, if that's how people process. But as far as going into it, knowing that our voices and our faces and our names are going to be everywhere, I think that's something that we've really like was a part of making that decision of, do I want to be in this specific role? Would I like to be? Because I mean, that has been a reason some people have like stepped down or been like, because this kind of work isn't really accessible to everyone. There's a lot more that goes behind like, you know, the organizing. And then there's the people whose faces are taken pictures of, who are locking down. But it's like, you know, many, 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 many more people behind all of this being able to be possible. So I think a lot of it is identifying and leaving space for it to be accessible, to contribute in different ways, whether that's sharing things on Twitter, whether that's being a media contact, whether that's, you know, showing up with like a medikit, or just being at home and being able to receive calls, or showing up to drive people home when they got released. Like there are lots of different ways, all very possible, or else it wouldn't be sustainable, right? Because the activist burnout is like very much a real thing. And I think that we have all experienced that in such a way that has prevented us from being able to do the work for some time, and are trying to be very cognizant of that and very mindful of expressing that within everyone if they're coming into it, be aware of the impact that this has. It's not only just like physically exhausting and putting your body in such a way, but mentally, like emotionally, like I'm recovering from that, because I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing that happens, but that we even have to do this and that we even have to put ourselves in these positions to be seen, to be heard because of the war that we live in. It's, you know, it's a very emotional process. So I think really a lot of support in reaching out afterwards, like people have been reaching out if people need food, drop offs to their homes, if they just want company, support, someone to talk to, body work after the fact. I think that is really important in helping to sustain each other, to make sure that these things that we are sustainable within this movement, and that we are leaving space for things to be accessible to different folks that have different needs and different capacities.
Does Black Sea specifically work on issues around focusing on Oakland or the entire Bay Area?
I think lately we've been trying to focus on Oakland. We discuss things that are within the Bay Area because we wanted to support with the No New Jail SF campaign most recently, and with the violent murder of Mario Wood. We have been attending vigils and supporting, so we definitely want to support San Francisco, but most of us are in Oakland based, and some of the community outreach and support we're trying to build is definitely in Oakland, but we're supportive of the whole Bay Area in general, just as far as our own capacity and access, and trying to recognize that not many of us do live in San Francisco nor are from San Francisco. In Black Sea, there are some people that are from Oakland. Not many of us, but there are definitely a presence of us that are from Oakland, and most of us live in Oakland.
So let's talk about the action on the Bay Bridge. How did you all strategize around this day, this place, to have that action occur? And if you could talk a little bit about what the objective for that action was.
We specified to do that, on Monday because of it being Martin Luther King Day. And the last 2 years in Oakland, for the second year in a row, the Anti-Police Terror Project put a call out for 96 hours of direct action to reclaim Dr. Martin Luther King's legacy and his radical legacy. So that was intentional in why we picked Monday, and also because of the symbolism of walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And so we wanted to do this as a paying an homage to that radical action. And because of the constant sanitization, the whitewashing of Dr. Martin Luther King's radical legacy that is often, especially in the Bay Area, living within a lot of the liberal, white, progressive, nonviolent complacency politics, especially when we try and reclaim that legacy and show that and honor it in the way in which we, Dr. Martin Luther King, as far as his radical wisdom, and reclaim that for our folks and our people and what it really is. So we wanted to shut down the Bay Bridge kind of as a resistance and to a system that continues to oppress, that continues Black, queer, brown, indigenous, other marginally oppressed people throughout the Bay Area. And we specifically wanted to highlight especially some of the violence around healthcare. We have the Flint, Michigan water crisis, to people being murdered because of their mental health disorders that police are completely unaware of and not compliant within doing proper protocols. And in general, the systemic oppression within the healthcare industry that does not value Black health in general at all. So we decided to do this in San Francisco. We've seen, such neglect and such violence by the SFPD and by Mayor Ed Lee. So this was really coming to take a stand, to be visible, to show that really, complacency and inconveniencing some people to try and throughout this whole system, throughout white supremacy for centuries. My comrade Thea really put it well. And I saw this clip the other day, and when someone was asking about how she felt about the convenience, it's 400 centuries of white supremacy is an inconvenience, So we were trying to take that opportunity, and it was also really beautiful to be able to open it up in which we can have these conversations with people on the bridge, and we are helping them to assess their needs. We have food, we have water to share with them, and if there were any serious medical conditions, we were ready to help us.
So there were bulleted demands. The immediate divestment of city funds for policing and investment in sustainable, affordable housing so Black, brown, and indigenous people can remain in their hometowns of Oakland and San Francisco. The resignation of Mayor Libby Schaaf, the immediate termination of Chief Reg Sur, the immediate termination of Chief Sean Vent, the immediate termination of the officers involved in the murders of Richard Perkins, Mario Woods, Yvette Henderson, Amelie Carr Lopez, Alex Nieto, Demuria Hogg, Richard Lennard, and O'Shane Stevens. So those were the demands that were particular to this action on the bridge. So how did you feel that you were received by the community and by the police during and in the aftermath of this action?
So I think that, well, within my immediate community, it's been a lot of support. Came out with a lot of phone calls and text messages and emails and messages. It's been like overwhelming to try and respond to everything. So that has been really overwhelming my heart. But then, of course, you know, I read some things and I read some comments and I have gotten some messages and emails somehow. And I actually received a phone call from someone getting my phone number. I've experienced this before of getting some like hate mail, whether that's email, whether that's messages on Facebook, people trying to find you on Instagram, being really upset about the inconvenience. And for me, that is to be like expected within this, and like how I go about engaging has like shifted, and I do like I understand, and I think some folks it's a little bit harder to hold as far as like the emotional and how it wears on you when someone is tearing your person apart, whether that's your image, picking apart aspects of your identity, whatever. And I know that some of my comrades have been experiencing that, but for me going into it, I try and ground myself in expecting that something like that is going to happen. I haven't experienced too much of that, but it's been present, absolutely. But as far as community support, that's been really amazing. And I've seen the coverage. There has been some, I'm just amazed at how widely covered it is. I mean, but I guess we did shut down the Bay Bridge, so makes sense. But there has just been a lot of within media, which is also just like wildly frustrating and makes me really hopeful in value independent media, because there's been just like a lot of factual falsehoods, a lot of inaccuracies, a lot of talking to people and then taking one word from them, which we go in and expect and kind of know that the media does this, especially mainstream media, right? But I've grounded myself in this and done this enough to have kind of been like, nothing has been too wildly shocking. And for some things that are incorrect, I think that we may respond in whichever ways. But as far as that, I'm also appreciating the coverage, like, and internationally. As far as the police, how they treated us. So the police that were on site immediately were the California Highway Police. So CHP were the ones that were arresting us and detained us initially. And then they transferred us to the SFPD and Bryant Street downtown, because CHP does not have the capacity nor experience with any kind of mass arrest like that. But that being said, it was very obvious that they did not have experience on protocols, because we were all in zip ties for about like six and a half hours or so. We had started the action around, I want to say we were probably deployed by like 3:30-ish, and met our goal of 96 hours, which also a lot of media is saying we did not. Probably, we were in zip ties for 6.5 to 7 hours, which it was excruciatingly painful for a lot of people, myself included. And we were denied water, food that whole time. And we were never put inside to process. We were transferred from CHP, and then we were brought to SFPD, where we were then outside basically in their parking lot in pins while we were waiting for them to finish. And they just cited us and released us at that point. So we got out around like, I want to say like 11:30. But throughout, I mean, that process, the police were, CHP was definitely hypervigilant in trying to say that and make sure and check that they were not hurting people or kept asking us that. But I saw something that they said that they were compliant in moving people's zip ties to the front. That was not true. People in the room I was in requested that, being in excruciating pain, and that didn't happen. We had to really fight to be able to get to the bathroom, and to the point that one of my comrades was going to have to just go to the bathroom where they were. Charges we all received, for the most, I think we all received the same three, and some of us four.
What were the three charges that they gave you guys?
I believe they were obstructing a highway, failure to disperse. Some of us got a false imprisonment charge. I believe that was me and my other comrade that were in the lockboxes, and obstructing a highway, public nuisance charge. One more, I can't remember off the top of my head. Obstructing highway, false imprisonment charge. I still have to research, because I was not expecting that at all, and it's very interesting and in what that actually means. But the rest of them, they're all misdemeanors, but they also do have their misdemeanors with the potential. Some of them can be like 6 months to a year, which we are very much hoping that that is not the case, but really interesting to see which direction the prosecution, district attorney, and the sheriff's office of SFPD are going to take, considering a lot of, I've seen some articles come out about the way in which the Black Friday 14 charges were dropped and people being fearful of them coming with a heavier hand for us, or that meaning, or what else that may mean, considering the public and considering we are in the Bay Area, and the Bay Area has like a legacy and culture of protesting and of resistance, and we were completely nonviolent. And so I'm curious, but I'm very, very grateful to have such a supportive legal team working with us, really.
The first demand, which was the immediate divestment of city funds for policing and investment in sustainable for affordable housing, seems very radical for a lot of people. And it rings of the prison abolition movement and some of the work that has been around that. A lot of people are very concerned that if policing doesn't exist, that there will just be scary anarchy, Mad Max situation in the street. How did you guys come about this specific demand, and how do you explain this specific demand to people?
It feels like Mad Max out here.
Already, right? But only on Black and brown bodies, right? So that's the thing, is that for white people, it feels extremely secure. It feels good. You know, they're allowed to go about their business without harassment. Right. They're allowed to do petty misdemeanor type things like smoke weed or run a red light or make a false turn. Without fearing for their lives, right? You know, they might get a ticket if they're riding their bike on the sidewalk. But, you know, Freddie Gray was killed for riding his bike, right? So in their eyes, they're like, okay, law and order is all that keeps us, keeps this whole clock ticking. So how do you explain how the police apparatus works differently for different communities and what that void would mean for people that are very unfamiliar with this idea of abolishing a police force or a community that doesn't have a police force?
For some of those conversations with some people, I try, because there's so, like, already going into that kind of conversation, there's already, I'm obviously aware that there is some things that they're unaware of, right, because of the lack of experience, right? Try and portray it in a very overarching sense of taking it back to where a lot of these systemic injustices are originated throughout, like, our history, right?
It's definitely a hard question, because it's an issue of kind of like through the looking glass, a massive difference in perspective between white communities and Black communities, especially when it comes to policing and what the effect of hyper-policing of communities are. One thing that's really interesting is that if you go into any white suburb in America, you don't see a police car. They don't have more police. And so that's not what makes them safe. What makes them safe is that they have these resources, right? That they know their neighbors, that they have these communities, that they feel safe. But in areas where you have more police, people feel less safe. And generally, those areas that are hyper-police, you know, you end up in this chicken and egg sort of cycle of overcriminalization of certain communities. And we've seen that with the drug war, you know, and the massive three strikes laws and the policies that have led to just the destruction of poor and color families all throughout the United States. So I understand that your audience isn't always those people, but even, you know, your moderate Black person, right, your middle class Black person, very hard
Absolutely.
Time envisioning a world or even a community where police don't exist.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had some experience with some of those conversations. In engaging in initiating some of those conversations, well, people always go back to, well, okay, police in general, but then, like, well, these people that commit these crimes, and then these crimes, and then, like, where are they going to go if these police are, or then it comes into, like, a prison conversation, which to then me, I start to talk about, like, a mental health conversation, because that's, like, what a lot of this comes back to, or systemic trauma, the cycles of abuse, and not having resources, and that's, like, what a lot of this is, and like what you mentioned, is not access to, you know, resources. What really is a crime? What really is a criminal? And who determines these things? And what is stealing something that you need that you have no access to, that it's, so these people have, like, so readily available to them, right? So that's one way, like, steps in which, and those become, like, larger overarching conversations in which, but a lot of these things are so intersected into our development, a lot of our access to needs, right? These systemic little injustices and oppressions in which create this like system, this like caste system that they're so unaware of. But as far as police do it, trying, like, people are not really familiar with the idea of community policing and like what does that really look like. And I'm always trying to shape my analysis of that and what does that really look like in a sustainable way. And I've been able to see some of that here, in which neighborhoods, blocks where people, when they have conflict, when they have folks to call, folks that have been living in the neighborhood for a while that know a lot of people that can help de-escalate some conflict. So try and bring up some of these examples. Especially for me, it's a lot of, I'm a prison abolitionist, prison divestment person at heart. I have a lot of family members incarcerated. So that's what a lot of it comes back to for me. It is the way in which we villainize and demonize people and that are struggling with mental health. And the fact that these things are set up in place that we don't want this person to have their need, because then if they don't have their need, they're going to turn to this, and then we're going to be able to profit off their body in enslavement. So a lot of these conversations can be hard, and to be honest, like, I feel like that's part of the work that activism sometimes has a large gap with, is doing this work on the streets. But those engaging in those conversations are really, like, that's a very important work, especially in the aftermath all the time. But like, we can be like, you know, and I think that helps initiate some of those conversations in different communities. You know, like, maybe you're like logging onto the computer in your Midwest suburb and like finding out about this shit and like, huh, and like reading it. Like, that's what we hope, right? As far as like engaging in these conversations on a wider scale. And often I think in Black and Brown organizing, we don't always like want to prioritize having these discussions with white people, and that's sometimes where white folks need to step up and do some of that. But also within Black and Brown communities, we need to have these discussions ourselves, because, like you said, like the like Black middle class, whatever, moderate progressive, still. And I mean, there were Black folks on the bridge who were upset that we were doing this, because I mean, I think there's just like such a culture of fear that is just like instilled of, and we, I mean, we live in violence, so we are going to internalize some of this violence, and it's very real that like if I'm assaulted, like, okay, well, what is my alternative then to the police? If this thing, what is my alternative? And I think a lot of that is like, we need to build alternatives and build them within our communities, like to community support in the way that people are going to rally to help you maybe replace your iPhone that got stolen instead of you getting somebody locked up for it, right? Like, that's just going to change the way in which we live, the ways in which we hold each other, and what we really put in when we say community. What does that really mean for some people? Before, I felt very jaded and in what that means, because it's like a word that's put out a lot. But I mean, in the last couple of years, and especially through this has really broadened my eyes to like what the world that I want to live in and what the community that I want to be a part of, and being able to actively see people in their boundaries and being visionary on what that really means, because that's I mean, we can help liberate each other through that. And those moments feel like liberated moment for me. An important thing that can sometimes get lost in translation, but also in which the like little steps in which people and how that people live their lives.
The thing that you've mentioned is trauma and mental health, and this is something that is often overlooked in our communities. When you mention trauma, the first part of this question is, how do you define trauma? And how do you try to deal with trauma within your activism?
How do I define trauma? Well, I feel like I can't really answer that question, because trauma and how I feel about it is really defined by the individual. Or I feel like it's like a term that has so much meanings for different people. Trauma and PTSD are very similar and sometimes synonymous for some people. But, oh gosh, trauma.
PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah. Whew, how do I go about it within the activism? So in my organizing activist experiences, I've done some work in Philly and then moving here to Oakland. So those are only my two cities of reference to some of my experience. And something that has really shifted as far as Black Seed, and I'm part of why I value, and I'm very happy to be a part of Black Seed and found a political home, is the centering of talking about it, of discussing it in ways in which feels accessible to different people's needs. Because we all, right, are like constantly traumatized people as like Black bodies in this world, you know, like whose survival is the day-to-day survival is exhausting, right? And there's so many little things that are all right. But how I try and make it feel a little bit sustainable is really trying to be honest within capacity and to be honest and have those discussions be like a larger thing of like, okay, let's like really check where we are, because some of these things are really triggering for people. And something that I really appreciated with this last action is even just having a moment to check in with the folks that you're doing it with your support people, of what are some of these triggers or things for me that might put me into another state in which I don't feel as in control, or I don't feel like whether it's like a panic attack or induced into a state of not being able, like complete debilitation. For me, it's comforting as much as it is painful to know that the people that your comrades have all experienced, like, oh, we hold different identities and we're all of different Black folks within the diaspora. So our perspectives and identities are all very different. But there's this collective kind of understanding within some trauma. And to me, as unfortunate that is, that it exists, it's wildly comforting, right? Because like, even within regional differences of places that I've grown up, I haven't always had access to people that just like share an understanding within some of the things that I've experienced, right? So that helps me cope and helps me hold my trauma and feel like if I feel like there's space to be able to process and to acknowledge it, because I think that's also something, kind of going into the other question, within like activism, activist circles, activist communities, that we don't, we're very aware of, but we don't always leave space to process within with our comrades, with our communities, if we need that. You know, some people do not process in that way. As far as my personal trauma that I've experienced in my life, I have shared some of that with my comrades, and some of that I think helped shape like an understanding of some of the things that or some ways in which I react to different things, and also some of the things that people prioritize or their values within the group, or the things that they like to do or like to actively build towards. And it's something that just in general I am fascinated by. You know, fascinated doesn't always like mean a good thing, but I'm fascinated because of just like our societal structures within trauma. Like, I didn't even know what trauma was until I was like 18 years old. Like, I never learned about trauma in school. You don't learn about mental health in school, you know, these are like most public schools. So these are things that like I had to be taught by my community, and that helped an understanding of my experiences. And some of that can be comforting, even as terrible as it is, especially in a systemic way of how it sets people up for death or for violence to be locked up. A lot of that just feels intentional. And it's really interesting too of how we can internalize trauma as children. And that's, I work with children. And that's so that I'm really fascinated by development and all of the internalizations of things and how they correlate to your life as an adult. And there's so many children living like traumatized before the age of like 4 or 5 that are exposed to so much violence, and people question or how these internalizations that are oppressed, they're dissociated for years and years. Of course, these things are going to manifest themselves in such a way, and these people don't even know what it is, right? I think trauma is an important aspect of a lot of marginally oppressed people's lives, and I feel like we need to have more discussions around even just like you said, what that word means to different people, you know?
We talked earlier about how you center queerness and transness within your group. I think for the mainstream, the idea of queer people taking center stage within activism seems very foreign. As you mentioned, there's no talk about trauma in public schools, but there's also no talk about queerness mm-hmm. in public schools. And so by and large, especially I would even say within communities of color, queer people are somewhat invisibilized. And this is done in a thematic way. How do you feel that queerness somehow affects you or colors your perspective or the group's perspective and their processes?
Oh, so many ways. Because like you said, queerness is also like visible in different ways. So some people could like look at that line of people and not have any idea that we were queer, or some people might be like, girlfriend on the right, she looks like she's queer.
I did. I just want you to know. Before I read the press release, before I was like, what are all these queer women doing on the bridge? I was like, oh man, what is happening?
That's great. Yeah. I think it's a lot in the ways, so many things, but I know that some of us are not intentionally not in other groups because that is a value that we don't believe is centered. And whether that's like one or two queer folks maybe in this like one other group, but the feeling of the group in general and what they center in the prioritizations feels a lot differently. Like I've been in some that just feel very heteronormative and like, is there really space for me? Or am I constantly having to feel like I even in this space have to advocate for myself and these people because you're not centering them, you're not discussing them, you're not bringing and really enrapturing all of our freedom. This feels especially important. But how we kind of queerness within Black scene, it's really interesting too, because I feel like a lot, like we're not queer only or queer and trans only group, but a lot of us are queer and or trans. So some things also just like happen organically, right? But I think how it shows up in our activism, there's certain things like we leave space for culturally within queer culture that I feel like there's a lot of discussions around trauma. There's a lot of discussions around triggers. There's space for, we're not going to assume your gender representation. We're not going to assume like, and I think that we structurally put some of those things in place because of our own experiences with queerness to try and really hold that and center that and make this feel comfortable and accessible to different folks, different, what that means for different folks, right? But how that shows up in some of our activism, I think, well, that, like we like to do some strategic things, like maybe some of like trying to be visible. It's hard to be visibly queer, but right, sometimes we can succeed in that way. I was really intentional in like as a queer woman, as a queer femme identified woman, I really was intentional in trying to present in that way, to be visible in that way, to aid in the visibility of queer like Black militant femmes. Because I think even within queer culture, there's always going to be things that we need to work through. Like there's always going to be, it's hard for any like marginally oppressed peoples to not, like we're constantly having to decolonize ourselves, constantly having to deconstruct white supremacy and misogyny and internalizations of patriarchy, all of those things. And I think that queer, some of the queer activism I've been part of is just like there's a little bit more, there's like more room for an understanding within in deconstructing those things. I think just through shared experiences, it just like creates a different kind of work culture is a good way for me to put it, I guess. And in the things that we are trying to advocate and really make visible and honor are like queer and transcestors are like ancestors, because like you said, like folks don't know about Bessie Smith. Like James Baldwin is a popular name, but not nearly in the same ways that Dr. Martin Luther King is, you know. Lorraine Hainsbury, like many people have read her book but don't really know much about her life. I go into these things really trying to honor that wisdom, that to be more visible, but not in a place that we need like visibility to feel valid. Well, we need visibility in general, but not like as far as an activism to feel validated in the work that we do. I think a lot of, for me in Black Sea, some of it is just like a structure, advocating for that within our, of a group, and some things really are happening organically. And when there isn't, are some things that are not, because that can help happen within like any activist culture, queer culture, people start using these words, like these terms that a lot of folks don't have access to or aren't aware of. Like I didn't really like understand a lot of things within gender identification until, because like I said before, we're not like taught these things. People in different areas don't have access to this, and some of that becomes intimidating for them. So I think for me personally, I try and bridge that gap of awareness and try and create space for there to be an understanding without immediately assuming that there is like a hateful ignorance, because sometimes it's not the case. And especially within Black communities, some folks don't know what I'm talking about when I say like a cis man or a cis person. Instead of the quick jump to immediately someone's unaware of this, that means that they're not down, like that it's hateful ignorance. Not necessarily. And I think it's important. And I've seen in Black Lead, I was trying to leave space. And I think that that's something that also in a lot of queer organizing, I haven't always seen displays or discussions around that, of like, because we can just turn into a bubble, right? Like with any kind of activist social circle where you're really talking about organizing with each other, and like these things are for not accessible to the wider group of people who also like don't always have access to some of this information, these terms are that you're using. Leaving space for some of that, and leaving space for folks to be in solidarity in a way that feels accessible to them. But within, I think a lot of structurally, it's hard because I feel like just what we show up with is so much like we're already here for, I mean, for ourselves as being like a lot of queer people in our activism and feeling silenced in other activist communities or invalidated, that people are not interested in centering that struggle also, which then makes, you know, more disconnected from a group of people that you're trying to build with or trying to build freedom and liberation with. And when we're out there, that like liberation that we're fighting for, it is all of our Black comrades, all of our comrades of color, you know, it's really for everyone.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a struggle to maintain that as part of the core identities of the organization, while at the same time making it so that you don't create a cultural bubble whereby through class privilege and educational privilege, you have a set of language and a set of sort of queer tools that aren't accessible to everyone, even all queer people, right? One of the critiques that I saw about the action on the Bear Ridge, and the critique was something to the effect of, well, San Francisco Bay Area is the most queer friendly place in the world, right? So... You know, even within the queer community, a tremendous amount of lack of understanding of intersectionality.
Yes, absolutely. That's a much more eloquent way to put it. Yeah.
My final question is about pitting ourselves, envisioning ourselves as people that are struggling against a system that is really designed towards our destruction. Imagining ourselves in the future. Or even imagining ourselves in the present, as fully alive, as fully functional, as people that have an ongoing healing process. And so really that question distills itself down to whatever it is for you, and this is a very personal question, that inner force that keeps you going, that lets you wake up while dealing with the aftermath and bureaucracy of an arrest for protest, for legal protest, right? Or the aftermath of just being in your body with your identities in this world. Mm. How does that lead itself? What's the power source of that? Is it electric? Petroleum? Enlightened.
Ooh, something I think about often. Yeah, it is a very personal question in some ways too. I'm someone that struggles with depression, and a couple of months I've honestly felt that in so much, and I can do a tendency to self-isolate. So Monday especially emotional because I had not been a part of anything like that in a bit. And just in general, I felt like fear has been coming for me in different ways, even fear of just in general going out and going on the street. So something that I was searching for, that of like, what's going to ground me before this and really hold me down and make me feel like that power source, like, right? And something about it felt so spiritual. And something, I mean, about that, when I was talking to myself to calm and ground myself before going into it and meditate, is really like, this is an act of me trying to envision and living and trying to create in the moment that world that I want to live in, that visionary future where you can get out your car with your comrades and stop a bridge and demand to be heard, right? Because like an act like that shouldn't be in the world that I want to live in, shouldn't be legal. It should be, if these folks are doing this, there must be something that we need to pay attention to. And part of me quelling some of that fear is understanding that white supremacy wants me to be so riddled with fear that I'm compliant within, or that I'm so debilitated by it that it overwhelms me and that I cannot be the militant, resistant person that I am in my day-to-day life and in the movement. And so I think a lot about fear, and what really been thinking a lot lately in the last couple of months and the places that I've been out of, really about friendship and about community and about how they have been my teachers and my pupils. And I feel this spirituality within friendship that it is like a liberatory practice. It can be in the ways in which we really defy those, we create different definitions for what that means, and like the intimacy, the magic within that. I feel held by that spiritually. And I think when it comes to these things, and I'm like a very empathic person, so I feel things really intensely. I feel pain very intensely. And I think that's also part of why I am an activist organizer. Like, I have always been that way. But that's really my power source. It's pain, but it's also this beauty of this like spirituality that I feel within people, like my community, people that I don't even know that are experiencing, and just like humanity in general, like feeling, letting myself really feel like those webs of interconnectedness within all of these different like intersections of our identities. But a lot of that power source lately has really been coming from there, and coming from a place of like, we all deserve freedom, but also like, I deserve this. Like, I deserve to try this. Like, I deserve to, and like, for me, it's it's like, I'm not going to give up unless I have nothing left of me to give, really. And I want to do that in a way that's sustainable, because the movement can be a lifelong process, right? But it would be nice if we all just got free in like 5 years. But realistically,
so it's not going to happen in 5 years? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it might. right. Well, let me speak that into fruition. In 5 years, when we get free. Yeah, I think a lot of that power source comes from that, and from really like a lot of honoring the ancestors and to honor the land. As like a kid, I never really developed a relationship with the earth. And I feel like that's a part of systemically thing that folks try and disconnect like Black, Brown, Indigenous people from, is this relationship with the land and the earth in itself. And I've been working and building towards that and as an aspect of my healing. I think coming back to those different sources, like my ancestors that I feel with me and then I pray to, and then the land and the earth in which I fight for, and the people in which I fight for, all kind of keep me held in this like blanket of comfort. And sometimes knowing that even within that, sometimes I just need to take care of myself. And that's an act of resistance, really, in this world that we live in right now, even that in itself. So I think a lot of that helps me stay grounded and to realize a lot of the fear that I feel is fear. Fear wants, they want me to feel this fear. And fear is a very real for different things, and especially different experiences, whether they're traumatic, love experience and violence. Yeah, I think a lot of that's my collective power source, is really trying to draw energy from all of those spaces and be honest with my own boundaries and capacity in order to sustain for the long haul.
Reek, I want to thank you so much for doing this interview with The Queer Truth. I feel so enlightened and so inspired.
Oh.
So do you have any parting words for us?
No. I mean, I just appreciate you holding space for this and trying to support and hold us down and leaving room for... Thank you for bearing with me throughout this process. It's not too experienced, but it also is a little bit more comfortable talking to you than some, like, person at CBS. So thank you.